This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 15th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 238. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the Is It Just Me commentary, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and the big deal feature, how to solve the problem of violent extremism in Canada. Bad actors on the far right and bad actors on the far left, they're all corroding democracy. Former CSIS director Richard Fadden testified at the House of Commons, and you'll be surprised at what he had to say. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or does the new Royal BC Museum have the potential to be John Horgan's version of Glenn Clark's Fast Ferries? On Friday the 13th, May 13th, Horgan announced his signature megaproject, the $789 million rebuild of the Provincial Museum across the street from the legislature. The new museum will open in 2030 and is promised to be more Indigenous and more seismically safe. The Fast Ferries failure of the 1990s was the legacy of the NDP under Glenn Clark, three poorly engineered vessels that more than doubled in cost to almost $500 million. They were eventually sold to the United Arab Emirates. Could the mega project museum be the next mega NDP scandal? The museum project is happening at a time when there are still too many Indigenous people living in poverty without housing around BC. It also happens when there is a shortage of construction workers in BC and rising costs of everything. It's doubtful that Horgan will be in office by 2030. Speculation is rife that he will retire before the 2024 election, so it'll be up to someone else to deal with the inevitable cost overruns. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The House of Commons Public Safety and National Security Committee is studying the rise of ideologically motivated violent extremism in Canada. Ideologically motivated violent extremism is also known as IMVE or IMV. It's related to religiously or politically motivated violent extremism. And together, there are national security threats that are identified by Canada's intelligence agencies. Incidents range from racism to anti-government violence, fed by online radicalization, conspiracy theories, and foreign meddling. It's on the far left, and it's on the far right, and it's been amplified by the pandemic. The committee met May 12th, and one of the witnesses was Richard Fadden, the former director of the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service from 2009 to 2013. More than a decade ago, Richard Fadden famously warned Canadians that China and Russia were actively meddling in Canadian politics. Here is his presentation to the committee, including ideas to solve the rise of violent extremism.
IMV has been around for a while. Indeed, it was on our radar, although not with the priority it has today when I was at CSIS. The difference is that then there were far fewer people involved. In some ways, it was less intense, and it was less organized and less coordinated. To state the obvious, the better organization and coordination today are because of the internet and its various manifestations. Also, those involved with IMV clearly feel much more intensely about their concerns than was the case, I think, a couple of decades ago. This last point, the growth in intensity over the years, is the case in part because no one has really tried to get at the root of the causes of the dissatisfaction, which is at the base of IMV. I know that your order of reference does not specifically direct you to examine the causes of IMV, but I would urge you not to ignore that aspect of the problem. Whatever preventative and legal measures are necessary to deal with the violence, I'm convinced that alone they will not be enough to stamp it out. Even if we succeed in doing so, it will not be the end of IMV because, like most national security issues, it is not purely domestic in nature. Whatever the origins of IMV, it always receives some ideas and moral support from abroad, if not sometimes funding and training. Unless we do a China, and isolate Canada from the internet, which is unthinkable. I do not see how we can stop ideas and support from abroad, which brings me back to my point about addressing the causes of envy as well as its kinetic effects. To deal with the violence, we will need control and punitive measures, but these must be built as narrowly and transparently as possible, or without intending it, we will be promoting the further development of envy. This leads me to the question of who is best suited to deal with the root causes of envy. While they may have a role, in my view at any rate, it is certainly not CSIS or the RCMP or police more generally. Provinces, cities, and civil society will have to be involved. Perhaps the federal role should be developing a framework, coordinating, and perhaps providing some funding. So in summary, envy has been with us for a while and has deep roots. It goes to the effectiveness of our democracy. Violence is not acceptable, even if we must accept extreme views. Dealing with envy's root causes is an integral part of dealing with the problem, and this must involve more than the police and security agencies. Control and punitive measures are certainly necessary to suppress violence, but they must be narrowly targeted, lest we make things worse.
A question from Manitoba Conservative MP Raquel Dancho.
Can you just give the committee in perhaps a minute or less, just a few overviews of what you believe to be some of the causes, what drives people to extremism in this regard?
Thank you. I think fundamentally what drives people to this sort of thing is the sense that they are not being listened to. I mean, fundamentally, they come to the conclusion that the political structures that we have at various levels are ignoring them. We find their views sometimes distasteful, and they are driven over time to what we would call acts of desperation. But I think fundamentally our democratic institutions have not adapted to dealing effectively with people who have views that fall outside of the mainstream. And that is infuriating, and it drives people, I think, to violence.
Would you say that if the Prime Minister of the country obviously said, you know, certain people have fringe, unacceptable views, he's called people misogynistic, do you think that that fuels any of that?
I don't think that attacking views is helpful by anybody, not by you, not by me, not by the Prime Minister. You can disagree with them. That's a different issue. But I think the Prime Minister went a little bit beyond that, and I don't think it was helpful. And it's the sort of thing that reinforces the sense that they're not being listened to. I actually disagree with most of the views that were being expressed in that general context, but that's neither here nor there. We need to find some means of dialoguing. Just like when I used to work, I used to argue that we have to find some means of dialoguing, for example, with the Taliban, because if you don't talk to them somehow, you ain't going to stop fighting them. So my argument is we cannot start a priori by arguing that they're wrong. You can argue they must not engage in violence. That's an entirely different issue, and I want to separate that very carefully. You pass that line, you become engaged in violence, and you got to do something about it. But we need to find some way of talking to them.
Certainly, and that was certainly the position that the Conservative Party took, that we need to not be pouring fuel on the fire because that only makes it worse. It sounds like you would be overall in agreement with that position, that we need to open up that dialogue. I'm also concerned, do you feel that sort of any government's exclusionary policies, for example, now not looking to debate the mandate specifically, but rather vaccine mandates, the impact they have on excluding those from society, do you think that that could drive people to extremism?
I think it can, but on the other hand, if we're going to live in society and live in a society that believes in the rule of law, if you take that view, you have to face the consequences. I don't think you should be ostracized for doing it, but if the law says you have to be vaccinated in circumstance X, Y, or Z, and you're not, and the law provides for penalty, then you have to deal with the penalties.
And just going back to the Prime Minister's remarks about calling those who didn't agree with them fringe, unacceptable views, and misogynist, he is, you know, frankly, the most powerful man in the country. He should be leading by example, and he really, regardless how you feel about it, it certainly sets the tone about how other authorities who report to him can act and what they can say. So again, I'll just throw the last few seconds back to you. Can you further elaborate on when you get that kind of power speaking in that way, what impact does that have on those being driven to extremism, doubling down? For example,
I think it has a negative impact, but to prove that I'm nonpartisan and I've had that beaten out of me after 40 years of public service, I would say that certain members of parliament who actively supported acts of lawfulness were not any more helpful.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bloc Quebecois MP Christina Michaud.
Could you elaborate a bit on what the roles of these members of society would be? What role can we give them in the fight against IMVE, ideological extremism?
One of the challenges that we have in Canada in dealing with IMVE or terrorism or things of this nature is that aside from yourselves and a few of your colleagues, unless there's a crisis, we do not talk about it. We just don't. I mean, to be blunt, there are no votes for you in talking about national security unless there's a crisis. So there are a whole raft of other problems to be talked about and to be dealt with. So I think the first thing that these civil society could usefully do is talk openly about these things so that we don't think that everything has to take place under the color of darkness. Because when that happens, people very quickly find themselves driven to the end of the spectrum that I was talking about. So a lot of it is talking about it. A lot of it is having organization. I mean, I hope I'm not going to get myself in trouble today, but, you know, I really do think that political correctness has reached the point today where it's almost impossible to have a conversation about a whole raft of issues. And if you're frustrated with government and with society to begin with, this is not helpful. So simply organizing and, if necessary, funding dialogue and conversation that could eventually work their way up to you and your colleagues with suggestions for change would be where I would start.
BC NDP MP Alistair McGregor.
So there's a responsibility for our political leaders to not set an example that is encouraging that type of behavior. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on, you know, on that approach and if you can just further elaborate on those concepts.
It's a good question. I had not thought about that. It seems to me that it goes back to some degree, though, to what I was saying a moment ago, which is that, broadly speaking, these national security or serious crime issues are not things that we want to talk about, period, in this country. We just don't talk about them. You know, I supported ministers over the years, and they would do virtually anything to avoid having to deal with the national security issue because there's no win. You can't win in national security. It's just not possible. You're irritating somebody somewhere. So it seems to me that the beginnings of what you're talking about is talking about these things positively and negatively. And I don't know how that's going to be possible, because if you'll forgive me for saying so, the political environment in Parliament today is very, very partisan. And anybody who takes an initiative slightly off the beaten path is susceptible of being beaten about the head, if you'll forgive me for saying so. I'd argue, as somebody who's worked in this area for a long time, that national security should be an area where there's less partisanship. And we've seen this over the years come and go. But there's a risk in doing this. There's a real risk. And I think if you don't create sort of a bubble around people who are trying to do this, it ain't going to work. And if you can't do it, then who can is the next question, you political leaders. And I think there are other leaders in society who are susceptible of doing this. I continue to believe that the universities have a role in this sort of thing today, but as I was perhaps unwisely saying, political correctness is preventing much discussion now about some of these issues. So I'm not doing a very good job at answering your question, and I apologize, but it just seems to me that more discussion generally, with some protection for somebody who's willing to take a little bit of a risk, would be a good place to start.
You know, I guess my question is, like, we've had a lot of witnesses talk about deplatforming individuals, like trying to cauterize the wound to isolate them. Do you take the view, is like sunshine the best disinfectant to expose these people as much as possible, or is it best to try and isolate the people who are causing the most harm, as some of our witnesses have suggested, through the agency of deplatforming them?
I think the light of day is always the best place to start. I really do. But having said that, there are provisions in the law now that allow the government to go to the courts and to seek orders suppressing various platforms and whatnot. I don't think that's been used very much, and I think that's to some degree is a cultural issue. You know, it's a new way of doing things. It's a bit risky. Anybody or any minister who authorizes this is taking a risk that he'll be accused of really not protecting constitutional rights. So I would say the light of day, some dialogue, and if need be, suppress. But suppress as precisely as you possibly can.
That was former CSIS Director Richard Fadden appearing at the House of Commons Public Safety and National Security Committee on May 12th.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Manila Times, business groups back BBM government. Two of the Philippines' most powerful business groups are willing to work with President-elect Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr.'s administration in sustaining economic targets that will speed up the country's recovery. Bongbong is the son of the corrupt ex-dictator Ferdinand Marcos and Imelda Marcos, the first lady who bought 3,000 pairs of shoes. In the Taiwan News, Taiwan to start fourth COVID vaccine doses next week. The Central Epidemic Command Center announced the fourth dose of the vaccine will be made available as soon as next week, beginning with people 65 and older. The fourth dose is recommended 5 months after the third dose. The second booster can consist of a half dose of Moderna, a full dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, or a full dose of a protein subunit vaccine such as Metagen or Novavax. In the Sydney Morning Herald, meet the anti-communist activist behind the Kim Jong-un stunt. Drew Pavlou, 22, is running for the Senate in Queensland under his Drew Pavlou Democratic Alliance to challenge the Communist Party of China and any Australians who do not denounce its reign. In Melbourne on Friday, a Kim Jong-un impersonator crashed the campaign of Prime Minister Scott Morrison, declaring Liberal MP Gladys Liu was supporting the Communist Party. Pavlou was assaulted by Chinese nationalists at Queensland University in 2019. Last week, he was arrested for carrying signs that said, "Fuck Xi Jinping." That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, baby formula shortage leaves Portland area parents scrambling. The Abbott recall exacerbated an existing baby formula shortage related to ongoing supply chain disruptions, a labor crunch, and transportation delays. Parents stockpiling during COVID-19 lockdowns also diminished the supply. Some stores are limiting purchases to just 4 12-ounce containers each day. Mother and Child Education Center in Portland said the shortage especially affects low-income parents and caregivers. In the Seattle Times, Amtrak Cascades from Seattle to Vancouver, BC postponed another half year. Transportation officials in Washington State hoped the trains would roll again by summer or even late spring. Amtrak doesn't have enough conductors, mechanics, and onboard service staff yet to operate the trains. Almost 300,000 people a year rode the service before the pandemic. Washington state lawmakers this year approved $150 million to study and plan high-speed rail between British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon, but such a vision is estimated to require at least $42 billion and decades to construct. In the Victoria Times-Colonist, BC Ferries hires 500 to help prevent sailing cancellations. A global shortage of trained mariners is making it difficult to fill empty positions, as well as COVID-19. These days, BC Ferries is dealing with about 11% of its workers off at one time, up from a typical 4%. About two-thirds of the new hires are entry-level seasonal workers. With the new hires, BC Ferries has approximately 5,400 employees. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
And it don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Canadian athletes taking a stand against abuse and corruption in Canadian sport. Bobsleigh Canada skeleton athletes demanded change at the top after a disappointing Beijing Olympics. Now gymnasts. A class action lawsuit was filed in BC last week by Amelia Klein, a former gymnast who is now a lawyer. The catalyst for Canadian athlete activism? former Whitecap Kira McCormick, who blew the whistle in 2019 on former coach Bob Berarda, who is now facing jail time. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 15th, 2022. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 15th of May in 1919, the Winnipeg General Strike started? It lasted 6 weeks, and it inspired similar protests across the country, including in Victoria. It also led to Canada's labor movement. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.